This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Parker from the Friends Committee, and welcome to Curator's Talk, the next in our series of Curator's Talks, where Dr. George Main will be talking about his research into the development of the Australian pastoral industry called Never Enough Grass, an element of the Creating a Country Gallery, which is due to open next year. So, George.
Thanks. Thanks, Michael. Yes, so today I'm going to be talking about Never Enough Grass, which is one of 10 modules or sections within the new Creating a Country Gallery that's been under development for a few years. The gallery is going to open sometime in the second half of next year in the area that is now occupied by the Nation Gallery. And the idea of this new gallery is to look at 10 big themes in Australian history. And to do that, the museum is going to be focusing on a handful of places in relation to each theme. So instead of trying to tell very broad general stories about these quite big familiar themes in Australian history, the idea is to tell them in terms of the particularities of places and the encounters and histories that unfolded, you know, within those places in relation to the themes that we're looking at. And today I'm not going to try and give you an overview of the whole gallery or even of the Never Enough Grass module so much as to look at one place in detail so that you can get quite a strong impression of that place and how we're going to interpret it in relation to Australian pastoral history. So my plan is to keep it pretty informal, so if you'd like to ask questions at any moment, please do so. And we've also got some images here, which are objects here, which I'll refer to throughout, which you can have a look at later if you haven't already. One thing I'm also going to talk about today is the significance of the field work that all of us curators have been doing as we've been developing our modules for the new gallery. And because place is such a focus for this exhibition and is the frame through which we're interpreting history, our visits to places have been really central in terms of how we understand and interpret places. You know, through focusing on place, we're implying that place and forces that are active within places help to shape historical outcomes. So in a way, we need to go to those places as curators and to experience that place and, you know, expose ourselves to those forces that are active within those places and that have shaped the realities that have emerged there today. And another really important part about going to these places is to build relationships with local people and institutions. Because our focus is on place and implied within that is that we're valuing those places and what's significant within those places, the opportunity to develop really productive and fruitful relationships has been very high. So I think what's one of the lovely things about developing this gallery has been a process that has taken place where the museum and the museum staff are sharing in the valuing of places that people who live within those places also hold. For each of the modules, each of the 10 modules within the gallery, the idea is each of the modules are exploring a particular idea or a philosophy or a problem that have shaped the way people have acted within those places. So not only is there the theme and the place, but there's a particular idea that we're trying to interpret in relation to each of the modules. And with the Never Enough Grass module, which is looking at Australian pastoral history and the expansion of the pastoral frontier in the 19th century, what we're looking at there are the cultural and economic dynamics that powered that expansion of pastoralism right across the continent throughout the 19th century. So it's this expansionist cultural imperative, its origins, its operation, and its consequences that we're focusing on and interpreting in relation to four places. So what I'll do now is give you a very brief introduction to the four places that we're looking at in Never Enough Grass, and then return to one of those places to look at it in depth and to show you images of some of the objects that are going to be featured in that place exhibit. So many of you will know of Springfield, the property just this side of Goulburn, where the Faithful family established a very well-known merino stud, and from where the Maple Brown family donated a lot of material a few years ago, some of which has already been incorporated into the New Australian Journeys Gallery. The property was established in the 1820s, and was a place where, of course, merino wool was produced, and the collection that we have reveals a lot about the processes by which colonial society were valuing the activities of the Faithful family and the produce they were producing, which enabled an independent economy to emerge in colonial New South Wales, as it was a good export commodity. The second place that visitors will encounter in the new gallery is Bowen Downs in central Queensland, which was established in the early 1860s by William Lansborough and Nat Buchanan, who secured finance from the Scottish Australian Investment Company. And this property supplied a lot of the cattle to pastoralists who were establishing stations further north in places like Katherine, where... So the Katherine district in the top end is the third of the four places that visitors will encounter. We're primarily looking at two stations in that area, Springvale Station, which was established in the late 1870s by Alfred Giles, who was managing it for an absentee owner, and Elsie Station near Mataranka, where Jeannie Gunn lived for a year and wrote her famous books. Derby in the West Kimberley is a very important port town and very much a significant node in the transport networks that extend across the West Kimberley and beyond. So this gives us an opportunity to look at a town and how the town and its institutions contributed to the pastoral industry. So now we'll return to Bowen Downs in central Queensland. It's a photo I took of the mailbox, and 1862 is a bit of a stab at the year it was established. That's probably when Nat Buchanan arrived to become manager. It was actually, the lease was secured earlier. So just to give you an idea of exactly where it is, I don't know how legible that is. It's not very legible here. But it's just to the north-east of Longreach. Longreach here. So up in these waterways that extend down through Longreach into the Thompson River, which passes through Longreach. So it's smack bang in the middle of Queensland. This is a map that the Scottish Australian Investment Company produced in 1863 to promote itself and to attract investment, presumably. And at that stage, the land was known as the Lansborough Runs. And you'll see that the leases were secured all along the waterways, which I'll talk about that later. So the Cornish Creek is the main waterway flowing into the Thompson River. So this is country that at that stage was occupied by the Inangai people, with Dalaburra people further to the north. So, in 1860, William Lansborough, who was put in charge of an expedition to find Burke and Wills, who were missing at the time, travelled down through through from the Gulf. Actually, it was 1861, sorry, which was just after he'd secured the leases for that country. So he'd passed through that country earlier and then secured the leases. And then in 1861, he passed down through that area again and arrived in Melbourne, where he was met with great celebration and presented with various items which honoured the work he did in terms of opening up this country to pastoralism. What I'll do now is just run through a series of photos which will help give you a stronger sense of this country and what it looks like before I go more into the particularities of the history. So this is a photo of the main homestead at Bowen Downs, taken in 1874. You can see the various vines. It might be honeysuckle or some such that they've got growing around there to keep the place cool. And the very flat, open, grassy downs nature of the country, which you can glimpse in the background. It's a much more recent photo of the taken from the air of the homestead complex. The homestead now is quite modern, and the various red-roofed buildings are still there. They're much older, and only a very small sample of the many buildings that used to be around the homestead, which was a very substantial centre of settlement from the air. And it's Cornish Creek, the main waterway, coming down there along the top. So all that land from the homestead area to the waterway is covered in archaeological relics and the footings of buildings, and down near the creek, remnants of the gardens that the Chinese vegetable gardeners established. A photo I stole from the internet. Just the flat open spaces of the district. The Bowen Downs was sold recently, and this is a photo from the sales catalogue that's showing a part of probably Cornish Creek that's dammed there, and again the open grassy country of mostly Mitchell grasses. Another photo of the which I took from the paddocks there, looking out towards the wool shed, and then the line of trees is Cornish Creek. And a recent photo from drought times in the district. Yeah, now this is the remains of a very large wool washing or sheep washing plant that was built in the 1860s. And it's an example of how visiting the place and encountering certain elements within the place really helps to give you a sense of the particular history that unfolded within that place. I'll just go back to, that's a sort of country that's more characteristic of Bowen Downs. As I mentioned, very open and grassy. And you come along and down into the creek at a certain point and encounter these vast industrial relics, which speak so much about the global capital that was financing the establishment of this station in the 1860s. And I think one thing that we're trying to do in this module is to counter some of the more popular stories about Australian pastoral history, that it was primarily a domain in which individual pioneers were acting within that country for their own interests, and instead tell stories about particular enterprises like Bowen Downs, where it was just as representative of what was happening in terms of the great flows of capital that were coming in from overseas, and it was really decisions being made in Scotland, in Sydney, by financiers and investors that enabled this history to unfold within this place. So this is the 1878 photo of the sheep washing plant. So you may know that sheep and wool were washed in the 1870s, 1880s to reduce the cost of cartage, of transport of the wool, to lessen its weight. And also the mills in England, I understand, were desiring that process to take place. It was discontinued as technologies changed in the mills. Now, this you may all have visited the Stockman's Hall of Fame in Longreach. One thing I haven't mentioned is that each of the four places within this module, each interrogate a particular sub-theme. So rather than trying to tell the same story or similar stories within each place, we've broken it down into certain sub-themes. And within the Longreach area, we thought it would be appropriate to interrogate or interpret the pioneer legend mode of storytelling, and so we've called it a national legend. So this is a mode of telling stories about Australian history that tends to honour the transcendence or the overcoming of certain constraints that pioneers encountered. And it tends to honour those people who didn't directly benefit from their endeavours, the pioneers who came first and did all the hard work and made our lives a bit easier. And these are the sorts of stories you often encounter when you travel into that area at local museums. And, it's a story that has elements of truth to it, and it's certainly a mode of storytelling that's very relevant to Bowen Downs, where William Lansborough and Nat Buchanan, overcame all sorts of constraints and problems to establish the station there in the early years. So this is a photo of William Lansborough and his two Aboriginal guides who accompanied him on his 1861-1862 journey from the Gulf down to Melbourne. And we hope to borrow this particular object from the National Library. So when Lansborough arrived in Melbourne, as I mentioned, he was greeted with much fanfare. His journey in 1861-1862 from the Gulf down through northern and central Queensland revealed that there was a lot of good pastoral country right throughout that central part of Queensland and northern parts of Queensland. And a lot of Victorians were keen to expand up into that area. He was presented with an extraordinary array of silver items by Sir Henry Barclay, the Governor of Victoria. And this is one of those pieces which we are borrowing from a descendant of Lansborough and will have as a centrepiece of the Bowen Downs exhibit. So the inscription at the centre of the silver salver reads, "To William Lansborough, Esquire, Commander of the Expedition from Carpentaria, in search of Burke and Wills, this salver and the accompanying pieces of plate are presented by numerous friends and admirers in Victoria to express their appreciation of the courage and skill with which he successfully crossed this continent and opened up a vast territory, won from the desert for Australian enterprise and for civilisation." It's a very dramatic wording which communicates a lot of the significance that colonists were placing on his activities. And according to the family, William Lansborough wore these buckles when he was presented to Queen Victoria. He married soon after his expedition and travelled to Europe and spent some time there. This item we're also borrowing, it's one I encountered at Bowen Downs as I was wandering around the sheds with the manager, and it's the rim from one of the big drays which transported items to Bowen Downs and took produce away, and the constraints of distance is one of the constraints that we're focusing on, and this wheel rim, of course, has done many miles and is part of that story of the struggles to overcome the great distances between the port of Bowen and Bowen Downs, many hundreds of miles away. And it's these sorts of items which perhaps some people who live at Bowen Downs or in similar places might not immediately think are of great historical significance, but in terms of the history and the dynamics which shape that place, I feel they have significance. I hope you agree. So at the sheds and right throughout that country that I showed you on that photo, you come across all sorts of items scattered around, which in themselves record something of the many people who have lived there and the great activity that has taken place at Bowen Downs over the generations. Many of the metal items which you see around the place have BD stamped into them, so they were made on the property by a blacksmith. I don't think it's yet happened at Bowen Downs, but many of the places that I visited across Australia to develop this module and another module have lost a lot of metal items in recent years as scrap metal prices have been very high and trucks have been coming, through the, travelling right across Australia, the scrap metal companies, and taking a lot of material away. And everywhere I went, people said, you should have been here last week because, the trucks have been through. And so, in some places we've secured items which now have all the other items that were there when I visited have now all gone because I beat the trucks. These are two bullock yos here. You can just see BD stamped on the outer one. So now just returning to that earlier map, another constraint which pastoralists in this area had to overcome before they were able to successfully establish grazing enterprises was the resistance from local Inungai and Dalabara people. Obviously when Lansborough and Buchanan selected all that country along the waterways, that led to tensions with the local people. It's not the it's quite a dry area, so water is of course of great value, both in terms of allowing people to survive, but also as a source of religious significance. And there's certainly evidence of tension and conflict erupting in this area. This is a document from the Scottish Australian Investment Company archives, which we'll be borrowing, and an original return of sheep. And you can see down, so on the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth line, it's recorded that 180 sheep there were killed by the blacks in April 1867. And this is a letter which Boyd Moorhead, who was the son of the manager in Australia of the Scottish Australian Investment Company, that he wrote to his father about this incident. And he had just arrived at Bowen Downs to replace Nat Buchanan as manager. And he wrote to his father, "Before my arrival, we had a severe loss from the blacks on Reedy Creek, who took away 400 of our weather weaners. Mr. Rankin, however, with his usual zeal, started after the robbers as quickly as possible and succeeded in recovering more than 200. Our loss thus standing at something under that number. This is a casualty heretofore unknown to us, and I have little doubt that it will never happen again." And he doesn't go on to explain or to articulate why it will never happen again. But we can probably guess. And this is Boyd Moorhead, a photo taken later in life. He became a parliamentarian. And in the 1880s, when a debate was ensuing within Queensland about violence on the frontier, Boyd Moorhead told Parliament that, and this is recorded in Hansard, "the country had been taken up and the colony had been made by men who had gone out and in their pioneering had of necessity to use extreme measures to the inhabitants of the soil. The Aboriginal, no doubt, had been shot down. No one denied it, and if they had not been shot down, the white man would never have been there." So this is, of course, is a very strong statement, and within the gallery, we've been identifying, or while developing the gallery, we've been identifying certain quotes that have a resonance almost like an object. So quotes like this will be presented almost as an object for people to consider and to make sense of in terms of their relationship to other objects and images within the gallery. This fellow is Robert Christison. He took a different approach to Aborigines in this area. He was a grazier, a pastoralist, who took up land just north of Bowen Downs. William Lansborough directed him to country just north of Bowen Downs on the same system of waterways. And he was able to befriend the local Dalabara people, and he allowed a lot of them to live on his property. He gave them protection against the native police, who were stationed at Bowen Downs for a while and were responding to reports of killing of sheep and so on by, it seems, killing a lot of people. You can see here there's... Robert Christison is either of the two bearded men on the right. They're two brothers. His brother was living with him for a while and they look very similar. So not quite sure which one's Robert. You'll see a pistol on the belt of this fellow and another pistol hanging behind the head of the man at the centre. So there's an extraordinary set of photos taken on Lammermoor of Dalabara people in the 1870s by a fellow who was working on a nearby station who had an interest in photography. And this sort of gathering of Aboriginal people, so close to a property, to the homestead there. Certain historians have seen this as a record of how trusted the Dalabara people were and included by the Christison family in the life of the station. So the fellow on the right here is known as Barney. He was the fellow that Christison first befriended and the key person who he negotiated good relations with in those early years. one reason we know so much about Robert Christensen and what happened on Lammermoor is that his daughter, who became Mary Bennett, was a writer and a great advocate for Aboriginal rights, and she recorded in detail the history of the station and her father's involvement with the Dullabarra people, and particular incidents where Christensen wouldn't allow the native police onto the property to do their work. And we actually have a descendant of the Dullabarra people on Lammermoor who works here at the museum, Lee Burgess, who some of you may know. So we've been talking with him, and he's been talking with his family members about what we're doing, and hopefully we can involve them somehow in the exhibition or the interpretation of the exhibition.
Who formed the native police?
The government, the Queensland government. Yeah, so their role was to counter any problems that were emerging on the frontier, to make it safe for pastoralists to establish their properties.
Were they white policemen?
They were led by white men, but they recruited Aborigines from outside the area, quite a few from New South Wales, I understand, who didn't have, you know, allegiances with the people there. And this is the breastplate. I'll just go back to that. You might probably see the breastplate there that Barney's wearing. It's not absolutely clear. But so this is now held by the State Library in Queensland, and one thing that I think is really interesting about this breastplate is the way that Christensen has included the various tribal names and indicated the sections within the tribe that Barney belonged to, which reveals something of the degree of intimacy the family had with the Dullabarra people. I mean, often breastplates say, you know, King George of Wagga Wagga, and don't include that sort of detail that's included on this breastplate. The British Museum in London has an extraordinary collection of objects which the Christensen family donated, so we're hoping to borrow some of those, including this photo of Weimar. And again, here the photo records you know, her names and how she fitted within the Dullabarra tribe. Again, recording something of the intimacy the family had with the Dullabarra people. So with this story about Christensen and our interest in, you know, the heroic dimensions of the pastoral history within this area, in a way, we're suggesting that Robert Christensen could also be considered a hero on the frontier, as someone who gave sanctuary to people in a very rare way. And this is a reed necklace and pendant made by Weimar. So the documentation is extraordinary about these objects. A lot is known about their makers, how they were made, what they were made of. And again, that in itself is recording something of that relationship that the family had. We're doing our best to record the contribution of women on the frontier, on the pastoral frontier. And it may not look like it, but this LC5 brand gives us an opportunity to do so. So LC5, the LC5 brand was the cattle brand of Bowen Downs. This item has had a lot of use. You can see the five has been worn away and part of the C. The LC5 waltz was composed by Edwina Edkins, who was the daughter of the manager of the of Mount Cornish, which was part of Bowen Downs, the cattle arm of the enterprise. And so she named a particular waltz that she composed in the late 19th century after the cattle brand, which indicates something about the romance of pastoralism, the value that Australian settlers placed on the enterprise, on the industry and the activity of pastoralists. So we're hoping that we could perhaps make a recording of this waltz and play it somehow within the gallery or allow people to listen to the waltz. And that's Edwina Edkins. Now, this man here is called Ned Wilson. He was a dogger who worked with Arimackshire Council for about 30 years. Some of his traps are displayed here, as well as the LC5 brand, which I just showed you. And on the top there, you might like to have a look at the LC5 waltz cover of the sheet music, which I printed out. That's one of the traps on display. So he's donated a number of his traps. He's also, in recent years, written an autobiography. So it's which is a lovely book and record of his life in the area, which provides a lot of context for the items he collected. He's donated. The Arimackshire Council donated some dingo bonus books, which records the number of dogs that have been killed in the area. So they still have to control dogs dingoes and crossbreeds in the district. And again, this is one of the constraints or the barriers to pastoralism, which people have had to overcome, which we are interpreting within the gallery. And this is a very interesting statement that or observation that Ned made in his autobiography. And I'll just read it out. I would like to learn more about dingoes. It's hard to learn about dogs when you're a dogger. It would be better to be able to sit for days and watch them from a distance through glasses to see what they do and how they develop. I don't think people understand that I would prefer to be able to do that. How can you learn a lot about an animal when you are required to shoot it? You get to know about the creature only up to the point where its life ends. You never get to understand what it would have done. That's disappointing. And what I think is really interesting about this statement of Ned's is that it shows how individuals are operating within a certain context, and that dynamic that I described earlier, that expansionist cultural imperative and the various processes by which society is valuing the activities of pastoralists and the pastoral industry and what it's offering Australian society. It's a dynamic in which individuals have to operate. So Ned Wilson's got a job with Aramac, or had a job within Arimackshire Council to destroy dogs, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's a free agent as he lives his life within this place. This is a familiar sight to people who travel through pastoral country where dingoes and wild dogs live. And, it's a bit hard to make sense of this sometimes, this practice, which obviously is very gruesome and confronting. The anthropologist Deborah Rose wrote recently about a particular dog tree which is not far from here up in the mountains to the south of Canberra, where there are many dingoes hanging. And she wrote, "In life these creatures were despised by the pastoralist, and now the deaths are displayed in a narrative of total power. The pastoralist wants to destroy the animal and he wants to display his dominance, and so he tortures the dead body. The dingo, this outlaw, can be defiled with relative impunity. Social power as well as interspecies power is on display here." These two taxidermied wild dog specimens were prepared by this taxidermist here, Paul Stumcat. The dogs were killed by the current dogger who's employed by Arimackshire Council. And our intention is to display these dogs in the same position as dogs are displayed within the Bowen Downs area, but to shroud them in a way which both allows people to encounter the practice of displaying dead dingoes in this way, but which also denotes other interpretations of this practice. The shrouding, which will be some sort of fabric through which you only partially see the dogs, will indicate that that the museum doesn't necessarily want to participate in this same practice of displaying power over these species, but instead we're interpreting that practice and allowing for a degree of respect also to be demonstrated towards these particular dogs which were killed by the dogger, not for the museum but in the general course of his daily work. So I'd be interested to hear what you think about this idea, either now or at the end. Now, I'll better speed up so there's time for questions. The dryness of that area, as indicated, by the desirability of the land along the waterways, is another constraint that people had to overcome to successfully establish this pastoral station. Here's a picture of a dam being built on Bowen Downs in 1878. This property, Kensington Downs, is a neighbouring station to Bowen Downs, and this photo was taken in about 1920. The owner of Kenya Station, which was originally part of Kensington Downs, donated this windmill recently to the museum, which was built in 1925 when the land which is now Kenya was Kensington Downs. And it's enormous. It's about 30 metres high. The fan wheel is over 6 metres in diameter. And it was a big job to dismantle it. Interestingly, the fellow and his sons who dismantled it, his grandfather actually built the windmill. So, again, it was an opportunity for the museum to work with local people who've got that extraordinary historical connection to the heritage of the place. And, it's unfortunate that this lovely old windmill had to come down, but it was gradually falling down itself. When we started talking to John Seckham, who donated it, the fan wheel was intact, and then the following summer, a storm ripped off some of fan blades, and so in a way, it's an opportunity to conserve this piece and to record its history. And there are other mills that were built at the same time, which are now have totally fallen apart.
Will you mount this one?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, initially we were hoping that most of the tower would fit within the gallery, but we've now had to accept that only part of the tower will fit and the entire fan will. So the idea is that it will be one of the big objects. This is a gallery that will have quite a few big objects in it, and this is one of the biggest. And we also had a photographer based in Longreach visit the site before the mill came down and took lots of photos. So again, it was an opportunity to work with a local photographer and continue building those links with people within the place, so that together we're representing the place here at the museum. And he was very creative and did things like scaled the mill and took these wonderful photos which set the context of the mill. So we'll be able to enable visitors to get a pretty strong sense of that, of the place in which that mill stood for so long. So I might leave it there. This gives about 10 minutes for questions.
like to report?
First, up the back.
Okay. Yes, could you tell us the details of the book by the Dogger from Aramac Council so we can buy it?
It's called A Dogger's Life.
Is it available in the shop here?
No, we hope to have it available in the shop. Are you online? Have you got access to the internet? All right. If you see me afterwards, I could get your details and I can send those to you. But Aussie Outback Publishing, I think, is the name of the company that published it, a few years ago.
Were the original leases ever fenced in the 1860s onwards? I noticed there was a piece of barbed wire in one of those slides that you had up there. Were they fenced immediately, or did that come after they lost a lot of livestock?
Yeah, no, fencing came after. Like, my understanding is that in the 1860s, a lot of those technologies weren't readily available yet, that wire fencing became more available in the 1870s and 1880s, especially as the railways extended out into that country. I think fencing started at Bowen Downs. Wire fencing started in the early 1870s, according to a former owner of the property who's done quite a lot of archival research and finished sometime in the 1880s.
How common was it for these big properties to change?
Are we recording this?
I think it depends in what part of Australia you're looking at. For this particular property, it actually stayed in the hands of the Scottish Australian Investment Company until the 1980s. So for more than a century. Initially, William Lansborough and Nat Buchanan and some other partners in Sydney owned the property in partnership with the Scottish Australian Investment Company, and then they sold it to the company who held it for a long time. And the Cameron family held Kensington Downs for some generations as well. A lot of these big properties were subdivided under closer settlement legislation, including Bowen Downs. So, that broke them apart quite a bit. Yeah.
This is just a comment, really. The poet Judith Wright's family took up land around Armidale, but a section also took up land in Queensland.
Oh, yes.
And she wrote a book called Cry for the Dead.
Yes.
Which documents the conflicts.
Yes.
Between white and black people and the dreadful massacres that occurred, which she says were really never exposed to the public or to the people in the South. Mm. So that the price that we pay for expansion in Queensland was terrible.
Mm.
As a nation, we paid a terrible price.
Mm. Yeah, we certainly hope that we can communicate, the significance of that component of the history within this exhibit.
Do you have a Nat Buchanan umbrella? He used to ride holding an umbrella.
That would be a great object, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it be great?
Yes.
Yes.
No, I've been in touch with or worked with Darryl Lewis, who has had a lot of deep contact with the Buchanan descendants, and He has assured me there's no umbrella still in existence. But
sorry about that. Yeah. On another point, I think it's a bit precious to shroud the dogs. I go past a place where they are shooting dogs that are mauling the sheep.
Yes.
And my grandchildren and I look at it. We all have our dogs and we love our dogs. But the message is that the dogs are mauling other animals.
Yes. I mean, what the in terms of shrouding, the idea is to that we have at this stage, it may change, but is to use this image on the shroud. So in a way, it's both increasing the exposure to the practice and within this place, as well as suggesting that that some people may find this practice, or allowing space for people to not be happy with this practice.
It's not pretty.
Yes.
But it's a fact of life.
Yeah. Yes.
Those dingoes, one of them looked like a crossbred, didn't look like a dingo that you had.
Yeah, no, that's right. There's interbreeding happening, certainly. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yes.
I'd like to hear you focus a little bit about the life of the women on these properties. You know, they had large families, some of them. What did they do with the children? What about stores coming in? Things like that. And CWA, was that around in those days?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I mean, this is only one of the four places through which we're exploring the history of pastoralism. We're not... in the way that we're looking in this place, focusing on Aboriginal conflict, and while Aboriginal conflict may have happened in other places, we're not going to be exploring at it in as much depth. So in this particular exhibit, the history of women may not be as strongly focused on as in other exhibits. We certainly do look at women's history. There is another object here which I haven't yet mentioned, from Elsie Station, which was made by a Mungarai woman in the 1830s and traded with the manager's family for flour and other supplies. And it's a ceremonial armband which the women on the station made at the time, a glass made from glass beads, and it's actually got HTT, the cattle brand for Elsie Station, beaded onto the armband. So here we have the HTT brand and the armband displayed, and in some ways that might help go towards answering your question, in that the stories that we're telling within this gallery are very object-centred, so and again very much embedded within the particularity of these places. So if we haven't encountered certain objects that offer stories, then we won't be telling certain stories. So we have objects which relate to women's experiences, and we talk about the particularity of those experiences in relation to that object and that place and that moment in time, rather than trying to present a general statement about women's experiences on the pastoral frontier. So, and some people may find that engaging, some people may not find that satisfying, and I suppose that's a bit of a risk that we're taking in the way that we're interpreting history in the gallery.
Mm. More questions here?
Just looking ahead, when you've obviously travelled extensively, getting all this information, when you came across older, perhaps, and interesting people, did you actively encourage them to write things down or to stay in contact with you or take photos? Or because, it's all very well looking at what's happened, 150 years ago, but looking ahead, I think what people are doing now and in recent history could be very important.
Yeah. No, I haven't been, but... yes. Well, I suppose this work in itself is all-consuming and quite exhausting. But no, it's a good point. We certainly should be encouraging people to, record history as it's being made. And I mean, in some instances, we are telling very contemporary stories about activities that are taking place today, set within an historical context. And one example of that is a retired drover and wharfie who lives at Derby, who I encountered when I went to Derby. And he now uses the jetty there, which was the point from which cattle were exported and wool was exported and supplies and people came in. He uses that jetty regularly to catch mud crabs and to fish from. So he has donated one of his mud crab nets, which we'll display in the Derby section. And we've also hired a local fellow there who's an historian and a filmmaker to record his stories about working as a drover in the area and working as a wharfie on the wharf there on the jetty, and also to record footage of him using the mud crab net and fishing from the jetty. So there has been opportunities to try and capture some history, from people. And in a way we're doing that to enable people to make sense of places as they are today, and to indicate something of the way that that history or the consequences of history are still unfolding within places, that that people's lives are set within an historical context and made sense of within the history of places and their own lives. Yeah. And our relationship with Ned, is very contemporary as well. We talk occasionally and he's helping us to interpret these objects and the history of that place.
Well, we're just about out of time. There's no more questions. This is surprising. Okay, well, just thank you very much, George, for that. It's been a great talk and a lot of interest, obviously. Thank you.
Thanks.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.